Hello, this is Albert Einstein. History myths fly around at the speed of light. Especially with that new internet thing you all seem to have. Thank goodness I have a direct connection to Professor Buzzkill, a fellow deep thinker who busts myths and takes names. I'm totally stoked. There's a new episode. I was stuck on this new equation anyway. E equals MC something. Something. Nah.
Hello there, Buzzkillers. We're back. And what's more important, Professor Nash is back to talk to us about the war in the Pacific from 1944-ish until the very, very end of the... This is the long defeat of Japan episode. Professor, how are you?
I'm doing great. We're going to bring it home.
We're going to bring it home. Thanks so much for coming back. You know, we spend weeks and weeks and weeks between these shows, and you're always willing to come back. It's just great.
It's because I have no life. I'll just ahead and just put that right out there.
We don't want to. I don't want anybody to know that. But we do want to tell the Buzzkillers that the Duchy of Buzzkill is now today under, the day that we're recording, is under flood alert. So if you hear sirens in the background or if we have to scurry away to higher ground, you'll know what happened. And certainly if you hear thunder and all the gods of weather raining down on us, that's what's going on. I apologize for that, but it might happen.
The Royal Flood Services are fully activated.
Oh, God. Yeah. Well, we'll survive probably. Probably. But we can't go into the bunker because that will flood. So there we go. So, Professor, we've gotten up to middle of 1944, end of 1944. What's going on? What's the situation in the Pacific?
You need a little sit rep.
Wait. Sit rep? What is that?
Situation report.
Okay.
I'm way out of my lane here.
Military guys.
Yeah.
Foreign policy guys.
Sorry. So the Japanese defense perimeter, which in 1942 at its peak was quite large, by this point is much smaller. They've been pushed back. The U.S. island hopping campaign has made considerable progress toward Japan by seizing control of a number of major island chains. Mid-1944, the Americans seized Saipan and the Marianas, which is within B-29 bomber range of Japan.
Okay, I mean, that's extremely important.
Yeah, and the bomber is perfect for that range. It's 1,500 miles each way, and that's a bomber that can do that. It's the unsung wonder weapon that actually cost more than the atomic bomb to develop. Interesting little fun fact. Okay. Yeah, $3 billion.
Let's do a show on that.
We should do it. It deserves its own show, no question.
So in a way, does that mean, in addition to the bombing that could have and was done from China, you've now got bombing coming in from the
right, and the main effort, partly because the Chinese, as the Americans are going to find out the hard way, the Chinese bases are very vulnerable to Japanese counterattack. Happens in 1944. The main bases are going to be in the Marianas, and there's going to be a massive bomber effort from there. This bombing campaign from China and then the Marianas starts in late 1944. It's not very effective at first. It takes months for the Americans to sort of perfect their tactics. But it does begin. The Japanese are tied down still in Burma and China. They're holding on to Burma, they still score major victories in China, but they never knock China out, and it's still a massive commitment. Probably about 1 million Japanese troops tied down in China. Japan's ability to wage combined war, which is to say sort of the combined air, sea, land, that ability to wage combined war has been destroyed. They can really no longer project power the way they could in 1942.
Yeah.
With big aircraft carrier task forces, that sort of thing.
And one of the things you stressed in that show, the previous show, was how much further advanced that sort of military technology and tactics were on the Japanese
early
side.
On, absolutely. Early on, they were superior in almost every way.
Right, right.
But by 1944, they've completely lost that superiority. Yeah. First of all, among other things, they've lost their core of skilled pilots.
Yeah.
And so American pilots are getting better and better, and Japanese pilots are getting worse and worse.
Yikes.
So
I shouldn't completely yikes. It makes it sound like we're obviously anti-militarism on this show.
Right.
But it is, the change is remarkable within a couple of years.
Exactly right. And the Japanese, by late 1944, the Japanese are barely, all their effort is into holding on to what they have. Mm-hmm. And they can barely manage to resupply and reinforce their existing defense perimeter. Right. So forget about projecting power beyond it, and by maybe getting into a major naval battle with the Americans. They're basically just holding on and just trying to resupply their existing garrisons. The key campaigns have been lost, basically. Japan is clearly losing the war. By any objective standard, there's no way by late 1944 they're going to turn this around. But what they have done, and if you're wondering, like, okay, so why are they still fighting on? They have, by this point, they've changed their tactics when it comes to defending islands.
Oh, okay. Okay, so not necessarily overall strategy, but tactics.
Right. Or to put it this way, the combined effect of tactical changes, they hope will have a strategic impact.
So in other words, all right.
And to explain what I'm talking about is they've lost control of the air, lost control of the sea. Originally, they would defend islands on the beaches, and they'd get creamed by American firepower.
Sure.
So by this point, they've changed tactics. And what they do is they fortify the interior of islands. Remember, a lot of these Pacific islands, even though they may be small, they're very, very rugged.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have mountain ranges on them, deep ravines, dense tropical rainforest. And so the Japanese decide to take advantage of that, basically allow an American invasion force to land virtually unopposed, or largely unopposed, and then make it very, very difficult and painstaking and costly for the Americans to seize the interior of the island.
Is this, this maybe, not maybe, almost certainly is an oversimplification, but is it a way that this is kind of turning into a land war in little spots across the Pacific rather than before?
Yeah, sort of several or even dozens of little land wars, absolutely. Yeah, okay. I mean, it is in many ways conventional ground combat.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, sometimes these islands are so small, it prevents the Americans from fully bringing all their weight to bear. For example, a small island with a limited front line, you can't just send in more and more troops to overwhelm them because the front line is not long enough.
Well, that's right? True.
And so compare it with France, where when the Americans break out of Normandy, they've got enormous room to maneuver. The Russian front, right, where you can make these big sweeping movements, and if you have numerical superiority, you can really make it count. Whereas in some of these cramped little islands where you're fighting cave by cave, trench by trench, it becomes this sort of meat grinder of small unit tactics.
Right. So the reason I'm asking that is because it sounds as if, in one way, it could sound as if the Japanese are giving up and they're just desperately clinging on by their fingernails. But this actually does, there is a tactical reasoning behind it.
Sure.
It could have worked.
Right. Or to complete the point I was starting to make a minute ago, you basically acknowledge that you're going to lose these islands. You're going to lose these island battles.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question becomes how? If you make it really, really painful for the Americans
over
and over and over again.
Yeah.
The idea is you make the American campaign so costly that the Americans might sit down and negotiate. And that's the strategic purpose here. And I would liken it in very broad terms to what the Confederacy does in 1864 in our Civil War, which is you're losing. The question is, how good a peace can you get? If you stretch out the war, contribute to the Northern body count, Northern public opinion will turn against the war, which it was, by the way, not to go deep in the Civil War, which it was in the summer of 1864. And Lincoln, for example, worries about not being reelected in 1864.
Oh, yeah.
People forget that. So you drag it out and make it so the North, even though they're winning, they sit down and negotiate and you get some terms or terms that are more favorable than you would get otherwise. That's the hope the Japanese in Tokyo are clinging to in late 1944. That you can remember the official Allied policy is unconditional surrender.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is anathema if you're in the Japanese leadership.
No, sure, yeah.
You don't want to be occupied and conquered. And so if you can make these island battles, even though you're losing the war in the big picture, if you can make the U.S. conquest of these islands sufficiently painful, the Americans might become war-weary and sit down.
Now, I can imagine that. I'm saying this buzzkillers, imagine, because I don't know, a lot of Japanese higher-up commanders saying, look, if the war in Europe ends sooner than this war, the American public might, as you say, get really tired.
Right.
If the Pacific War drags into 1946 and God forbid to 1947, having this negotiation settlement.
Right. Then they'll have the comparison right in front of them. Like, so why is this war taking so long?
Yeah,
right.
You beat the Nazis. How come
you can't? You know, and like when you're losing a war, you start to engage in wishful thinking.
Yeah, sure.
And we'll talk more about the Japanese leadership in a bit. But I should also mention at this point that another new Japanese tactic are the kamikaze attacks.
Ah, yes, yes. Famous.
Yeah. You've lost control of the air. So really the only air weapon they believe they have left is basically pilots turning into suicide bombers.
Right.
You take a plane, you load it up with as much gas and explosives as you can, and with a minimally trained pilot who only knows how to take off and aim, basically.
Yeah, not land.
Yeah. Then you just and you attack American invasion forces that way. That's another way of defending an island and making the American conquest of an island very, very painful, which in some ways they succeed in doing.
Okay, then what were the last major island campaigns?
Right. And people should keep in mind that in any quick and dirty history like this, you're leaving out a lot.
Right.
And you're leaving out a lot of, you know, they're not minor engagements for the people who take part in them. Let's put it that way.
Just the names of them. Everybody knows the names of them. And I don't mean to just ahead of time, but.
Right. So the first one is actually an early, that I'll talk about, is in early 1945, and that's Iwo Jima.
Uh-huh.
A pretty famous campaign. This was in a way, sort of the textbook cave and bunker defense. I don't think I mentioned it, but these fortification systems the Japanese build, often they take advantage of existing terrain, existing caves. They connect the caves with tunnels.
Yeah.
They have very well concealed fighting positions and bunkers put in place. And so basically the United States lands... certainly not unopposed, but they successfully land. But then comes the hard part, which is you basically have to blast and burn your way across the island. And if you read any account of a place like Iwo Jima, it's so frustrating for the Americans because you take out a Japanese position, a cave, for example, or a bunker,
yeah. Yeah.
And you think you've secured it, and then you move on. And then the Japanese reappear in that same space and start to fire at you from behind.
Oh, Lord.
So in a way, it becomes... Well, it's sort of like the Viet Cong tunnels in Vietnam, You think you've secured a perimeter, and now you're being fired from behind. How did that happen? Well, it's not magic. They've got tunnels,
yeah.
And they can move around, and it becomes, I don't want to sound glib, but it becomes sort of like whack-a-mole,
yeah,
right? Where you think you haven't secured an area until you've secured every opening and every tunnel and every cave in the vicinity. Because until you do, you think you've taken out a cave, and the Japanese can just move around and move back into it. So that's very frustrating and adds a lot to American casualties. Iwo Jima is successfully conquered by mid-March 1945, but 6,000 U.S. dead. 6,000 U.S. dead. That's more than, just for comparison, that's more dead than we lost in all of the Iraq War.
Wow.
In a single battle for a single island. 20,000 wounded. And a lot of these casualties, by the way, are inflicted on U.S. Marines by an enemy that... sometimes you don't even see,
yeah,
because they're right. Firing from such well-concealed positions or firing from behind. Now, if you're wondering about the Japanese garrison, almost the entire Japanese garrison of 21,000 dies.
The garrison in Iwo Jima.
The garrison in Iwo Jima, right. There are very few, a handful of Japanese taken alive. Once again, that's how the Japanese fought. But what's interesting about Iwo Jima, big picture, is that if you look at those numbers, so 26,000 U.S. casualties,
right.
21,000 Japanese casualties, asterisk, those are almost all killed in action. Nevertheless, for the first time, the Japanese have succeeded in inflicting more casualties than they suffer.
Oh,
that hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Now, there have been some bloody battles up until this point for the Americans, but they have never suffered more casualties than they inflict on the Japanese defending a particular island.
Wow.
So if you're in Tokyo, you're thinking, well, so this is clearly how you defend an island. This is how you make taking an island super, super costly.
So this idea of making the Americans pay so heavily, making the Allies pay so heavily, seems to be working.
Right, right. If you're in the Pentagon... and you say, wow, it's going to take us 6,000 dead, 20,000 wounded to take an island like that, and we have many more of these to take.
Not even counting the mainland.
Right.
The Japanese mainland. But.
Absolutely. Right. So that's going to be very sobering, right? Even though, by the way, you have done many, many things to improve your fighting ability, and you're using better weapons, and you've have all this experience under your belt, and you know how to take an island now, still... This looks like it's going to be incredibly costly. So fast forward to the next, and it turns out, last major island invasion, and that's Okinawa.
Yep.
Which is, technically, it's Japanese territory. It's part of the Ryukyu Islands to the south of the southernmost Japanese main island of Kyushu. It's about 350 miles from Japan proper. So keep in mind, 350 miles in the Pacific, that's like nothing at all. No, that's, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's well within your air cover.
Yeah.
For example, this is April to June 1945. Another massive amphibious operation. I forget the numbers, but the U.S. invasion fleet assembled for the invasion of Okinawa is by far the largest fleet ever assembled in the history of humanity.
Oh, my goodness.
It really is. It really is. If you look at the number of personnel, the number of aircraft carriers, just the firepower represented, it really does sort of reflect American power, military power at its zenith. There's no question about that.
Yeah.
There are lots of kamikaze attacks against the invasion force. 28 ships are sunk and 5,000 Americans are killed just in the kamikaze attacks.
Wait, 28 ships?
Yes.
And 5,000
ships of all sizes. Some of them are major, some of them are minor.
Sure,
but still,
even still, 28. Yeah, right. A hell
now,
of a lot.
Keep in mind, I forget the actual number of kamikaze attacks. Most kamikaze planes do not find their targets.
Yeah,
they've shot down because of the wall of anti-aircraft fire and defensive fighter cover they have to get through is really formidable.
And of course, they could miss. Even if, you know,
Oh, absolutely. That's right. Exactly. And that happens quite a bit. There are a lot of near misses or there are a lot of partial hits or like just the wingtip grazes the ship, that sort of thing. That happens quite a bit. But still, 28 ships were sunk with the loss of 5,000 American lives. We can argue whether that's a lot or a little. It's a huge, right? If you lost 6,000, dead on Iwo Jima, this is 5,000 among people who haven't even set foot on the island. Lordy. So that's a large amount. Now, by the way, this landing is completely unopposed. In fact, 3/4 of the island of Okinawa isn't even defended by the Japanese.
Wow.
Which is sort of, once again, sort of exhibit A or maybe exhibit B of their new defense strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's a pretty big island. If you try to defend the whole thing, it's going to be like on MacArthur on Luzon, right? You try to defend everything. You defend nothing. There's no way you could possibly defend it. You'll be too thin. So you deliberately just give the Americans 3/4 of the island. You defend the southern tip. You put up a series of incredibly strong defensive lines at the sort of a narrowest part of the island.
Yeah.
Right. So once again, they prevent the Americans from bringing all their force to bear. And it becomes this unbelievably brutal slugfest. I've recommended it before. I recommend it again. HBO series The Pacific.
Yes, yes.
Has a couple of fantastic episodes, fantastic in a bad way. Just very frankly exposing what the conditions were like on Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And how, for example, the Japanese use human shields at certain points among the government because they have civilians at their disposal. It's a savage struggle. Some of the worst fighting in the war. Finally, the Americans prevail, and everyone knew that was going to happen. It was only a matter of time. 13,000 U.S. dead, 100,000 Japanese soldiers, and 100,000 native Okinawans, who are Japanese citizens, lose their lives. Some of them, just as what you might call, I hate this term, but collateral damage. In other words, civilian death in combat because there's just so much firepower being unleashed. But some of these, and this had happened before on Saipan, but in a larger scale here, some of these Japanese civilians, including sort of parents with their children, commit suicide.
Yes, yes.
Because they've been fed a lot of propaganda about what's going to happen to them if they fall into the hands of American soldiers and Marines. So they commit suicide to avoid capture. A lot of them sort of jump off cliffs and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and particularly families doing that is very
distressing. It's a distress, an added distressing dimension to an already really distressing campaign. So it's really, really costly.
You know, I often think, and I think a lot of buzzkillers out there listening to this would think that if these islands are just kind of holdouts, and I don't mean that, you know, just five guys hiding in a cave, but it's definitely not being protected by lots of ships and lots of other military force. Why not just ignore them and go straight for the Japanese mainland?
Around, right. No, it's a good question. And by the way, you've just summed up what has been the basic tactic of island hopping up to this point.
Yeah.
Like, for example, major Japanese strong points like Rabaul down in MacArthur's theater, he wanted to attack it. By the way, I apologize for my string of gratuitous attacks against MacArthur's.
Oh, by the way, we did a show on MacArthur a couple years ago.
You should check it out, but I'm not a fan, just to give you a little preview.
And
I do not apologize for a minute. But no, it is a basic fact of island warfare, and what makes it so difficult to defend an island perimeter is if you strongly fortify someplace, the Americans can always go around you.
Right. Okay.
Now, the problem here is that as you get this close to Japan, most of the islands are very heavily defended, and you have to have these islands before you can invade Japan. You have to have a relatively close jumping off point.
Okay.
For the next step. So this is one island you can't hop, basically.
Gotcha.
If that makes sense.
The closer you start to get, the more fierce it has to be.
And by the way, it doesn't mean Peleliu is often held up, and this is also shown in the Pacific, as held up as an example
of this.
Docudrama, I should say.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There were island invasions which are highly dubious and maybe not strategically necessary. I don't want people to think that they've always got this down and they're always making the right decision, right?
Oh, okay.
Sometimes you hop an island, sometimes you don't, and maybe you could have hopped that one too. Peleliu, for example, is a great example. Super costly. Lots of Americans die, and a lot of historians would say not for any good reason. Okinawa does not fall in that category.
Yeah.
It's so close in. It's, like I said, it's in the closest non-Japanese island chain. You really do have to take this island or one like it, and they're all heavily defended.
And by the way, we should remind buzzkillers out there that you should please go to our YouTube video of this episode, because we've put up a lot of maps. And each stage, each island chain we're talking about is
help you visualize.
Yeah. Because otherwise it just seems like this amorphous sea, literally.
Right. But now we are really getting in quite close to Japan.
Close enough to then start this strategic bombing campaign?
Right. Well, strategic bombing you can do from a much greater distance.
Yeah.
But staging an invasion has to be close in. Right, because you're moving an invasion force and lots of men and equipment and all that you can't send over thousands of miles of sea.
Yeah.
That you have to do from close in, and also because you need fighter cover, as opposed to
strategic bombers.
Right, it was like when we talked about D-Day. Right, you have Normandy is chosen partly because it's within Allied fighter cover. You have to have local fighter cover to overcome the natural advantages that the defenders have in an amphibious operation.
Okay, so it's not just the bombers coming in from Tinian and Delay and all these places. They've got to have smaller planes to protect them, and those smaller planes can't come from Tinian because it's too far out.
And that's why you have to have additional island hopping. And they're really sort of parallel campaigns. B-29s aren't involved in support of amphibious operations. They're waging strategic economic warfare against Japanese cities and Japanese factories.
Yeah.
Whereas tactical air cover, fighter planes, which are very short range, those you have to have close in, and you need a base that's much closer to Japan from which to stage an invasion force.
How in the world this could be more complicated than it is.
And just all the logistical and the support troops and the planning and the intelligence that goes into these things is just amazing. I haven't even scratched that surface.
Okay, so my conception then is mistaken that this sort of clears the way for the big bombers leading up to the atomic bomb. But what this really does is it clears the way for a strategic bombing campaign, like you say, of lots of different types of aircraft.
Yes. And you can even make an argument, and some people have, that you technically, if you look at with hindsight, and if you look at the way the war's going by 1945, you can make an argument you don't need Iwo Jima and Okinawa. That with your naval blockade, in other words, you're strangling Japan partly with submarines, control of the sea, and your B-29s operating at long range, you can continue to pummel Japan without additional costly island invasions that move you closer to Japan.
Okay.
Right? If you really, if you weren't concerned about the war dragging on, big if, there's no reason why the United States couldn't have continued to bomb Japan, forgive the expression, back into the Stone Age from long distance, because that's what it was doing.
Those
bombers, by the way, Iwo Jima and Okinawa were never turned into strategic bomber bases.
Huh.
Iwo Jima was useful for B-29s that needed a place to crash land if they weren't going to make it back to Saipan or Tinian.
Because
that was so much further away. But they never developed that, probably because Tinian was turned into this amazing, the equivalent of a modern international airport that could support hundreds of B-29s.
The whole island is turned into runways.
Oh, my God. But people should go look at a map of Tinian, by the way. And they named the runways things like Broadway, which only the Americans would do. No, but the Seabees, the construction battalions, they did an amazing job just developing these islands into incredibly advanced strategic bomber bases. But you mentioned strategic bombing. So strategic bombing had started earlier from China with these B-29s. It was not very effective. Curtis LeMay, who we've talked about in other episodes.
Oh, yeah.
And in other contexts, he was put in charge of the bombing campaign from the Marianas. And we won't get into the details, but the changes he made were very, very effective. And he turned the B-29 force into a truly awesome weapon of destruction when it was set loose on Japanese cities. More and more by February, March 1945, Japanese cities start to be systematically devastated. Partly through use of incendiaries. A lot of Japanese, in fact, most Japanese cities, the residential areas are largely made of wood and paper.
Now, let's remind the buzzkills what an incendiary bomb actually
They are very small bombs, which means you can have a lot of them in one plane.
Yeah.
And their only purpose is to start fires.
Okay. Now, are there flammable, the technical term is inflammable, but most people get some it's one of those odd English language.
Two words that opposite words that mean the same thing.
Is there a gasoline type thing in the bomb itself that makes it worse?
Essentially a form of napalm, which is sort of jellied gasoline. When the bomb detonates, it explodes and it flies in different directions and it actually sort of clings and burns. But it's designed to start fires. Your average aerial bomb, a fragmentation bomb with high explosives, is meant to bring down a building through blast, right? Blow out the walls and make it collapse. And by the way, and sometimes as we talked about this in the Dresden episode, in Europe, certainly they drop some high explosives first.
Yeah.
To basically prepare the buildings for incendiaries. And I know that sounds perverse because it kind of is. But Japanese cities and Japanese air defenses are essentially non-existent.
Yeah, by this stage.
Bomber losses among B-29s over Japan is extremely low compared to what's going on in Europe. And some are shot down, but very few compared to what's going on in Europe. And so a lot of Japanese cities are being bombed. By the way, your average big Japanese city that has a lot of industry in it is bombed several times. They would be revisited to sort of finish the job. And a lot of these, I don't think any of these cities are completely annihilated, but most major Japanese cities with any industry to speak of are heavily damaged and parts of them wrecked. I think we may have talked about the bombing of Tokyo in March 1945.
Yeah.
Where I gave a talk once and I started out by describing the conditions on the ground in Tokyo, but I didn't say it was Tokyo. And if you look at the description, you could easily assume it was Hiroshima. For example, reports of molten glass drifting through the air because there were so many fires. It was a firestorm. 100,000 people were killed in Tokyo, March 9, 10, 1945, which is more than at Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, and done with conventional bombing.
Yeah.
So a lot of these cities are – a quarter of Tokyo was just completely erased.
And Tokyo even then was massive.
Oh, yeah.
Not only population, but geographically massive.
Yeah, basically 16 square miles just completely erased. Yeah.
And by the way, we most people only think of Tokyo and then Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but you talk about all these, for lack of a better term, secondary cities that were destroyed, and that's where a lot of industry was.
Absolutely, right. Places like Kobe and Yokohama.
And
Nagoya, places like that. They were all bombed. And by the way, additional condemnation is called for on the Japanese leadership because they knew this was all going on. They saw or should have seen what was going on, what was happening to their people in their cities. And they still said to themselves, well, we need to continue to fight on. That means a lot of this additional death after this point is on their hands. This is not just the product of American war making. This is the product of a Japanese leadership, same with the German leadership, that really is completely indifferent to the fate of their own people.
Yeah, which is genuinely sick.
It is super sick.
So all these people are killed, but then what are some of the other impacts?
Right, like so what? Well, by early to mid-1945, Japanese war-making ability is suffering mightily, and not only because of their battlefield losses, but also because of what's happening to their industry.
Mm-hmm.
They can know their production has started to go way down simply because their factories are being destroyed.
Yeah,
they cannot produce enough ammunition, new planes, new equipment for their military. Their industry is being ravaged. Production drops. As you get into mid-1945, the Japanese transportation network is increasingly targeted.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, for example, their railroad network within Japan is starting to be targeted. And by the way, let's be frank. This is partly because the U.S. Army Air Force is starting to run out of targets.
Oh.
They're, in other words, like, what do we do now? Well, we've bombed all these cities. We bombed all these factory areas. And so they start to hit the transportation network.
Let's blow this railway bridge.
With, yeah, these bridges, these railway trains, these harbors. So their economy really starts to suffer. And the idea that, I don't want to get into the whole atomic bomb debate, but the idea, if you look at what's happening to Japan without an atomic bomb, the idea that they would have otherwise fought on, like, for example, deep into 1946, really is ridiculous. They would not have had the ability to wage war just because of what the American bomber force was doing to their cities and their industry.
Okay, so it literally couldn't have done it.
Because it couldn't have done it, right. Okay. I mean, you know, and you can argue about when that point would have been reached.
Yeah.
But it was going to be reached. Certainly 1946 would be my guess. The Japanese, I've mentioned this before, I'll mention it here again. The Japanese also is increasingly strangled by U.S. submarines.
Oh, this is another thing I don't think of, submarines.
We ought to do a submarine show, and partly because I was just in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And at Pearl Harbor, it's not just the Arizona Memorial. They also have the USS Bowfin, which was a World War II submarine that's been refurbished and is now on display. And you can take a self-guided tour through it. It is fascinating. If buzzkillers ever go to Pearl Harbor, make sure you do it. Because it's not every day you get to tour. I mean, we have one in Pittsburgh. It's technically a post-World War II. It's a 1945 submarine. I don't think it saw any combat. The Bowfin certainly did. The Bowfin was one of the more successful U.S. submarines. It's a relatively small force, this U.S. submarine force.
Yeah, yeah.
After they figure out that their torpedoes don't work, which takes them about 2 years. Only in 1943 did we realize that we're scoring hits. Well, did we fully deal with the fact that we're scoring hits with our torpedoes, and all the Japanese hear is a thud. Because our torpedoes were defective. We finally perfect torpedoes that work. We weed out some of our less aggressive submarine commanders, and are with a relatively small force. It's smaller than Germany's U-boat force. It's only a few dozen submarines, but Japanese have completely neglected anti-submarine warfare.
And that's interesting for an island nation.
Yeah, among their many, many mistakes. Now, we did lose submarines. It was still very hazardous duty, but... our small submarine force by 1945 is also running out of targets.
Oh.
So thoroughly devastated I forget the exact percentage, but something, I want to say something like 30 or 40% of Japanese shipping is destroyed, or that is destroyed by U.S. submarines. They get no love, but they deserve it. They are acting with impunity. Remember, big picture, Japan is an island nation that is resource dependent on the outside world. It must have open shipping lanes to bring in oil and food, the basics, right? Yeah. We're not just talking things like bauxite and manganese. We're talking about basic stuff like rice and oil.
Yeah, and I mean, and it's been like that for centuries. You know, and it's not like all of a sudden in the 20th century they become dependent.
They're like Britain, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Very, very analogous. And the problem here is that Japan is being successfully strangled. And this would be another reason why I think they wouldn't have lasted long into 1946. In 1945, before they surrender, there were already signs of severe malnutrition in Japan.
Wow.
They don't have enough rice to feed their own people. And this is partly because... The life expectancy of a Japanese freighter, you can probably count in days.
Oh, no kidding.
And it's extremely hazardous duty because you know that sitting outside your harbors, first of all, there are lots of naval mines.
Yeah.
Which also overlooked. Our B-29s also drop from the air a lot of naval mines. These are mines that float underwater. They basically have a weight and a chain.
Oh, okay.
And then they're designed, right? They figure out what the depth of the water is where they're dropping it. And so then they basically float under the water.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they don't float on the surface. They float under the water at sort of hull depth.
Yeah.
And so a lot of Japanese ships are sunk by U.S. mines that have been dropped by American airplanes, which once again, control of the air allows you to do.
Oh, I thought you had to lay mines with a mine laying.
No, and that ship. I mean, that is the conventional way to do it.
But this is a whole
But when you're in the Americans and you have all this lavish military power at your disposal and all this sort of technological gift, your average Japanese harbor by mid-1945 is just this nightmare for Japanese shipping.
Because if you
make it through the mines, then there are American submarines waiting for you.
Yeah. And it's not like these cargo ships are heavily armored or anything like that. They might be convoys.
Your average torpedo or mine has quite enough high explosive to punch a fatal hole in the hull of one of these ships.
Yeah. What seems to be happening, it's just, it's I mean, again, this is sort of, I don't want to say presentist, but it's sort of like jumping ahead of the story that everything is closing on in on Japan at the same time,
yes,
all at the same rate of intensity. Mm-hmm. But Japan is still fighting on.
Yep. It is.
Why is that?
It is amazing. The end of the day, you have to look at sort of the character and the mentality of the Japanese leadership.
Yeah.
It's basically, it's run by military people. Uh-huh. There's a Supreme War Council, which is not entirely made up of military people, but mostly.
Right.
These are people who've all absorbed the code of the Bushido. Right. These are the people who think that surrender is inconceivable to them.
Right.
Because if you surrender, you're worse than a dog. And I think we talked about this. One of the reasons why they mistreat allied POW so badly. Because you surrender to me, you're a dog.
Yeah.
You're supposed to fight to the death. You're supposed to die for the emperor. That's what you're supposed to do. And basically, there should be no soldier or sailor alive when the war ends, essentially. Ugh. I mean, there are times when I read about this, I think this is not a military. This is a death cult.
Yeah.
That's really what it sounds like if you look at the way they think.
Well, Buzzkillers, were breaking the fourth wall by explaining how we run the show here a little bit. Professor Nash provides these wonderful script outlines. And one of the things, two of the things he mentions here in this section is feckless and delusional Japanese leadership hopes.
Right. That's how I would describe them. Feckless and delusional. Feckless in that none of them seems to have any independent will. None of them ask any hard questions. None of them is willing to engage in debate. And this is partly a cultural thing, I'm sure. But basically, they're on autopilot. They don't know to do anything but to continue fighting.
Is this why one of the reasons why that death cult thing
yes,
seems to be such
I think
a
that's
good
part of it. I think it's a, right, for example, and if you're part of that, I'll use the word cult. If you're part of that cult, who's going to be the first person to say, "Hey, you know what? This is a ridiculous cult. I want out."
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that could get you cashiered. By the way, that could get you killed. That could get you killed, even killed by one of your subordinates.
Yeah. Right.
Right. By the way, a lot of the problem here are the mid-level and lower-level people who are the true believers. And they are constantly looking out for superiors who are too weak. And,
wow.
You know, and this, by the way, I was reading a book about 1941 and how Japan gets into the war. And a lot of the driving force for that decision for war is not the top people. It's the mid-level people pushing the people on the top. And the people at the top scared that they're going to appear weak to their underlings.
Oh, my God.
So that's how sort of ridiculous this is, but also delusional. And that's something different from the death cult, different from the willingness to sort of fight to the death.
Mm-hmm.
Is that you continue to cling to hope. You continue to spin these fantasy scenarios in your head by which, oh, if only XYZ happens, we won't lose.
Yeah.
You know, you saw this in Nazi Germany. Well, our wonder weapons, if we fight long enough, the Allies will fall apart, right?
Yeah.
It's all ridiculous in retrospect. There's no way it was going to happen. But you continue to cling to it because that can also help justify you fighting on.
Yeah. But for those things to be successful, every single one of those things has to happen in the right
That's
way.
Right.
And the chances of that are minuscule.
Exactly. And one of the main things they're clinging hope to here is sort of at the diplomatic realm. And people should remember that even at this late date, sort of June, July 1945, the Soviet Union is a neutral power in the Pacific.
Yes, and that's fascinating, of course, because it's one of the big landmasses.
Right. So, I mean, and it's a world war. It's a global war. Most people are involved, but not everyone on every front.
So
if you're wondering, like, well, so who cares? Well, the Japanese are holding out hope, and some of their diplomats are busy in this regard. They're holding out hope that through the quote-unquote neutral Soviet Union, they can negotiate a peace that is better for Japan than unconditional surrender.
Again, this whole idea of trying to get – keeping the war going or keep technically as long as possible to get a better peace. And by the way, we should stress that it's not – the Soviets and the Japanese have signed a peace or non-aggression pact.
That's right, 1941. Right.
Yeah, and it's not just because – it's not – so I hear this all the time. It's not solely because the Soviets are fraidy cats or anything. They've got a lot to worry about on their own.
Right. They want
their Western front.
Unlike the Germans, they worked very hard to avoid a two-front war.
Right.
And by the way, at Yalta in February 1945, they do agree to join the war against Japan, which it turns out they do almost 3 months to the day. They agreed to do within 3 months, almost 3 months to the day they do join the war. And let's remember, this happens at the same time as the atomic bomb attacks. So August 6th, Hiroshima is bombed. We did an atomic bomb show. I'm not going to go into it. Hiroshima is attacked on, is bombed with an atomic bomb on August 6th. Nagasaki 3 days later, August 9th. In the wee, depending on where you are in the world, in the wee morning hours of August 9th, the same day that Nagasaki is bombed, the Soviets attack Japan. They declare war on Japan and attack in Manchuria. It is a devastating offensive. It only ends up lasting a few days or weeks. But this is the massive Red Army that has now been brought to a very, very sharp point by fighting against the Germans for 40 years.
Yeah, yeah, they know what they're doing.
Oh, they're super skilled. They're super tough veterans. They've got vastly superior numbers and equipment. And they basically, the Japanese Kwantung Army is what it's called in Manchuria. The Soviets go through it like a hot knife through butter. The Japanese suffer devastating losses.
And you often hear or sometimes hear from, you know, talk radio morons. We are not talk radio morons. We are podcast.
We're much brighter than moron.
That, you know, the Soviets only jumped in because, oh, they've dropped these tremendous atomic bombs there. Let's get in on the kill.
They do want to get in on the kill, but this was arranged well
also
in advance.
Part of the because it's almost, as you say, to the day when they agreed to do it.
Right. Well, and also, and this reflects a very quickly changing attitude in Washington. In February, it's like, wow, Japan's going down hard. We really need the help of Soviet manpower. In other words, we need Soviet manpower to help us out the way that they did in Europe.
Yeah.
Then fast forward to the atomic bombs, and maybe the war is going to come quickly. And now it's like, oh, wow, we really don't want the Soviets involved because then we might have to share the occupation of Japan with the Soviets.
Yeah, like the occupation of Germany.
Exactly. Yeah. We don't want to have to split Japan the way we have already split Germany. And so now becomes a reason why we want this to end quickly, especially once the Soviet troops have become involved. So even after all this, after two atomic bombs and after...
Yeah, Nagasaki's on the 9th.
On the 9th, and after the Soviet move in Manchuria, the Supreme War Council in Tokyo is still split 3-3.
3-3?
3-3. And buzzkillers out there should know Dr. Nash's iron rule of committees, which is when you're forming a committee, make sure it's an odd number.
All the committees that in the institute have
an
odd number of people. Gracious,
this is not rocket surgery, people. If you have an even number, you might get a tie.
Yeah.
And then what? Especially if you have no provisions for breaking a tie. Really, people? Are you running a modern country or not?
Well, maybe subconsciously this is a way just to keep
right, exactly.
To keep losing and then, yeah.
Yeah, no, obviously it could have gone 5-1 or 4-2, but no, it's 3-3.
Wow.
So if you're wondering, like, so who are these two sides? You have what are called the Peace Party and the War Party.
Right,
and
three people on the Peace Party, three people on the War
Party.
That's
right,
and
exactly,
the council anyway.
And on the Supreme War Council. And the Peace Party, basically, they are the relatively realistic group, as you might imagine, as the name might imply. It's like, we are losing badly. Let's end this thing. But still, they also have a condition. They don't want to accept unconditional surrender. Their condition is we get to keep the emperor, which,
okay,
if you know about Japan in this period, that makes certain sense. All Japanese of all stripes revere the emperor. The emperor has a sort of semi-godlike status. You can't imagine Japan without the emperor. The emperor and Japan are one. That's not something you're going to give up. That's something you would continue to fight for.
Right.
Which, by the way, if we can just take a step back here, is one of the criticisms by some people of American policy, which is if you announce unconditional surrender against a country like Japan, they're going to fight to the death.
Yeah, because of the emperor, right.
Couple that with the more realistic approach to wars, which is there's no such thing as an unconditional surrender in reality. There are always conditions. They might be harsh, they might be lenient, but there are always conditions.
Right,
so
right,
it's great
right,
propaganda, right. Unconditional surrender. It actually, and people like Henry Stimson, Secretary of War, he understood this.
Yeah.
Our own policy has gotten in the way of war termination.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the Japanese are going to fight to death because of their emperor. He knew a little bit about Japanese culture, by the way.
I sometimes wonder whether American public opinion at the time was sort of massaged by the American government to concentrate on the evils of Japan as being Tojo, as being... And you know, you never understand, we're fighting against
the
emperor.
In other words, so, like, separate the government from the people?
Yeah.
I don't know... I don't know how careful American propaganda was, and I certainly know wouldn't know what its effect was.
My sense
is the Japanese in general were demonized.
Yeah, okay.
And
so maybe,
let's keep in mind one of my most disturbing factoids I like to trot out, which is a Gallup poll in November 1944 found that 13% of Americans advocated extermination of all Japanese on the planet.
Oh,
Now, God. You could argue that the glass is half empty, right? That with all the propaganda and hatred in Pearl Harbor and Bataan, that maybe it should have been higher than 13%. But still, about one American in, what, seven thought that the way you deal with the defeated Japan is you kill all Japanese on the planet, men, women, children, exterminate them as a race. That gives you some idea of the added, in other words, and so to me, that means a lot of Americans don't differentiate between the Japanese leadership and the Japanese people, that they are, that they, as a people, they are a scourge.
Yeah.
Like I said, there's a minority.
Kind of reminds me of that thing in the Versailles peace negotiations where some people talk about the pastoralization, forced pastoralization of Germany.
Especially, and let's remember, this is total war that goes on for years, and people have been saturated with propaganda. That has a cumulative effect. You're hyping people up. You're getting people on edge for war. You can't just turn that off like a light switch.
No.
People are going to remain fired up, and that you know, that you've let that genie out of the bottle, and now when you may want to put it back in, the genie is not cooperating.
Okay, we're talking about the two basic war council parties, the peace party, and then there's
peace party basically says we'll surrender if we keep the emperor. That's their stance. That stance is anathema to the war party. The war party. Here's their stance, basically, which is we'll stop fighting, we'll give up, you win the war, but we disarm ourselves. Which is, I'm assuming, is partly an honor thing. Handing over your weapons and your sword. We disarm ourselves, but in other words, we're in control of that process.
Yeah.
Which, what conquering army would ever... Yeah, sure, you fellas take care of it yourselves.
Yeah.
We'll just hang back and watch.
Yeah.
Right. We will deal with our war criminals ourselves.
Yikes.
Yeah. Who will guard the guardians? That's sort of interesting chapter in that story, right? We expect the Americans to sit back. And remember, Americans have been victims of war crimes. The American people
already
calling,
know about it.
Know about them and are calling for some heads.
Yeah.
But we'll let the Japanese deal with their own war criminals.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, parenthetically, a lot of the Japanese don't even view them as war criminals. So, how do you think that trial's going to go?
Yikes.
And this is the kicker, no occupation of Japan.
Okay. So, in one way, the war party is still a surrender party, except there's conditions.
The conditions are, the D word, delusional.
Yeah, the war
that
surrender.
The Americans
the surrender
would
war
go
party.
For this. By the way, there were also people in the war party, maybe not in the Supreme War Council. There are high-ranking Japanese who also are like, yeah, we'll surrender, but we get to keep China. basically a do-over. Let's just pretend Pearl Harbor didn't happen. We'll go back to November 1941, big, powerful empire without us attacking... You know, let bygones be bygones. I mean, if that's not delusional, is there some stronger word than delusional? Delusional doesn't quite capture it.
Freud would have a field day on this, but also
how ignorant they are about what they're up against,
and also the sick nature of war crimes in China by the Japanese.
Oh yeah,
there's no way they could get up.
Right. I mean, there's human beings are typically not known for their self awareness, but the lack of self awareness here, the lack of sort of situational awareness, if I'll use the modern term, is just appalling. So the full cabinet then meets August 9th, 10th. So this is after these events, after the atomic bombings, after the Soviet, that, let's keep in mind that Hail Mary you've been banking on, right? A negotiated peace with the Soviets. That window has shut because the Soviets, they're no longer neutral. They've declared war on you. Your situation has changed radically. Still, the war cabinet is deadlocked. And that's
still 3-3 again.
Still 3-3.
Lord,
I'll say it again. Feckless and delusional. are you running a country in a war effort or not?
The F and D.
F and D. This is when the emperor, without precedent, intervenes.
Oh, okay.
Himself. Him personally. Now, remember, it's a complicated issue. Partly it's an evidentiary problem. We don't know everything because a lot of the key documents were burned by the Japanese. And also the Americans after the war are interested in making the emperor look good because we've left him in place.
There are
a lot of layers to this.
The one conditional unconditional. Yeah.
After the war, we sort of made him this apolitical, aloof figure who had nothing to do with the Japanese war effort, which is a lie really untrue. We have much clearer evidence now about his big picture complicity in, for example, the origins of the war in the Pacific.
Yeah.
But he finally intervenes. As far as we know, he intervenes on behalf of the peace party. This intervention, I'm pretty sure it's without precedent. He has informal ways of having a say in policy, and he sets a tone, and people clear things with him informally.
Again, not that different from the British monarchy.
Right, or some other systems, but this is a formal intervention. This is showing up at the meeting and saying, essentially, this has to end.
I'm the tiebreaker.
Yeah, exactly. Finally. And after this, on August 14th, or I think August 13th, no, take that back. August 10th, they send a message to the United States, we will surrender if the emperor is preserved.
Uh-huh.
So, and by the way, I think I talked about this in the atomic bomb episode, but keep this in mind, even after the Soviet declaration of war and two atomic bombs, the Japanese stance still isn't, okay, we give up, no conditions.
Yeah.
It's still, all right, we'll surrender if we keep the emperor.
Yeah.
They're still insisting on a condition. And then the Americans famously respond with this sort of indirect response, which is, and the quote is, the emperor will be subject to the supreme allied commander of the allied powers. In other words, they don't say, you get to keep your emperor.
Yeah.
Which, because that might not go over really big in some circles. You basically...
Back in the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. You sort of elide the issue and by describing his status as subordinate to the allied commander. But the subtext is clear. You get to keep your emperor.
Yeah.
So by the way...
In theory, it pleases everyone.
Just for those of you keeping score at home, it's not unconditional surrender.
We
grant them a condition. And that was also one of the reasons the Japanese surrender. And I still see it all the time. This 100% correlation. We drop atomic bombs and then the Japanese surrender. End of story.
Yeah.
You should be asking yourself, why is there this 5-day gap between the Japanese announcement of their surrender and Nagasaki?
Yeah.
They had a full meeting schedule. I mean, why do we have this 5-day lag? And the answer is the Japanese were still insisting on a condition and they got it.
So this is the biggest myth of the end of the Pacific War.
It's one of the big myths and it drives me nuts. You still see documentaries and then they show an atomic explosion and then the war ended.
Yeah.
Heavily implying, if not outright saying, that this is one-on-one correlation. That's the only reason they surrendered. As we like to say here on the show, it's more complicated than that.
The C word.
So the Japanese announced their surrender on August 14th. By the way, there is an attempted military coup.
Oh, Lordy.
When it's clear that the emperor has sided with the peace party, there are some junior officers who go nuts and they invade the palace and want to kill him.
Well, it's a junior officer. So again, junior it's this mid-level of...
The hardest of the hardcore.
Wow.
And... Well, of course, and they are willing to give their own lives, certainly, as some of them do. They think this is so outrageous that they will kill their god emperor.
Holy cow.
Well, again, that's not delusional. That's nuts.
Yeah.
I'll use that clinical term.
Yeah.
And then the final surrender takes place on September 2nd. But I have to mention the broadcast of it was called an imperial rescript.
Now, what does that mean?
I have not looked into it. The Japanese use this word all the time, or it's the English translation of the Japanese word, rescript. It's like an official imperial announcement.
Uh-huh.
But it has a higher status. It's like a white paper or something like that. Or I don't know what the British equivalent would be. But it's a relatively rare, formal statement of royal policy.
And so now let's listen to an excerpt of the audio from the Japanese emperor giving that imperial rescript broadcast.
各世界の体制と帝国の現状とに鑑み、世の措置をもって自国を収集せんと欲し、ここに終了なる汝臣民に次ぐ、神は帝国政府をして米英四祖四国に対し、その共同宣言を受諾する旨、
We've only given you a short extract from the beginning of the emperor's imperial rescript, and here's the translation of what you just heard as reported in the New York Times on August 15th, 1945. Quote, to our good and loyal subjects, after pondering deeply the general trends of the world and the actual conditions obtaining in our empire today, we have decided to effect a settlement of the present situation by resorting to an extraordinary measure. We have ordered our government to communicate to the governments of the United States, Great Britain, China, and the Soviet Union that our empire accepts the provisions of their joint declaration. End quote. We put the full text of the Imperial Rescript in the blog post for this episode, and of course you can find that on ProfessorBuzzkill.com.
That, and by the way, that is the first time the Japanese public ever heard the Emperor's voice.
Yeah,
that's how sort of aloof and sort of ethereal and sort of mysterious the Japanese Emperor was in Japanese society. So they broadcast his voice reading that Imperial Rescript, and that's, and people were like, among other things, oh, so that's what the Emperor sounds like.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing.
And so then, and as I said, that leads to the official surrender on board the USS Missouri, which you can also visit at Pearl Harbor. I realize I'm sounding like part of the Hawaiian Tourism Promotion Board, but I was just in Hawaii, and Pearl Harbor is an amazing historical site. And they have refurbished the USS Missouri, one of our massive battleships. You can actually go to what's called the surrender deck.
Wow.
Which is
and you've seen pictures of this MacArthur.
Yes,
and
some extremely, extremely... tiny area. Oh, it's a stage, but it's extremely tiny area where they cram all these people in. By the way, I have to add some more, a little bit of MacArthur bashing that I just found out.
By the way, hate mail at professorbuzzkill.com.
Exactly. Those lingering MacArthur fans out there, you send the hate mail to that address. MacArthur was evacuated out of the Philippines before the U.S. forces in the Philippines surrendered in 1942, so he could continue the struggle.
Yeah.
The commander left in charge was Jonathan Wainwright, who then spent better part of 4 years in Japanese captivity, which was brutal for most POWs. When he's liberated, he's skin and bones.
Mm-hmm.
MacArthur didn't want Wainwright to take part in the surrender ceremony.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. There's a picture of, I saw a picture of them hugging, and the caption said, MacArthur didn't want Wainwright there because Wainwright was a reminder of MacArthur's defeat in the Philippines.
Oh, talk about out of control egos.
Now you know why I don't think very highly of Dugout Doug.
Yeah. Well, you would think also that Wainwright could have been used as the, especially because he was a POW, they surrendered to him.
Yeah. Well, and he was not the, Percival, the British commander in Malaya and Singapore, was also on hand, and he was skin and bones. And big picture, not due to MacArthur, but there were people in the Allied camp who wanted people to see, look, this is what the Japanese did to people in captivity.
Yeah, even the top
guys. There's also
guys.
A bit of payback, right? You know, you have your losing commanders who get to have the victory dance in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This surrender's got so many threads to it. Can we say why? Is there one answer? Is it two answers, five answers? Why did Japan surrender?
In a way, this is going to be a cop-out because you're supposed to rank factors when you come up with a list, right? So that doesn't become this undifferentiated list. I'll defend this partly because it's difficult to say with certainty what percentage of this was responsible. Once again, partly because it's not a matter of what you're doing. It's a matter of what impact what you're doing has on the Japanese. And we don't understand that fully because of evidentiary issues. But it's pretty clear that the Japanese finally managed to overcome their systemic and mental flaws and throw in the towel. It's a combination of the atomic bombs.
Yeah.
The combined air and naval blockade.
Mm-hmm.
Which has been devastating and is devastating on its own. The Soviet declaration of war,
right,
and the Allied concession that the Japanese get to keep the emperor. You put together all those factors. I don't think I'm leaving out any major factors. Those are the major factors why the Japanese finally surrender when they surrender on August 14th. 1945.
So that's a lot. And again, it's complex.
It's complex. It's
strands.
Much more nuanced than it's often presented, even in documentaries. World War II with VJ Day, August 14th, 1945.
Mm.
Obviously, the jubilation in the United States in particular is enormous. World War II is finally over. Remember VE Day, victory in Europe, that was months earlier. World War II is finally over. I would just end with a lament for the price paid by the peoples of Asia and the United States and the Pacific, the price paid for fanatical Japanese militarism. The price was tens of millions of dead people.
Yes.
Absolutely devastating loss.
Buzzkillers may remember a show we did a couple of years ago on, I think, entitled Why Was World War II So Bad? And looking at the Pacific, the Asian casualties and the Asian deaths, enormous, especially the Chinese.
Especially
civilians.
The Chinese, right?
Literally shocking to the core.
A lot of the explanation for why World War II is so deadly happens in Asia and the Pacific. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, sorry to end on that depressing note about human nature, Buzzkillers, but We are here to tell you what we believe to be the truth, and in the truth there are an awful lot of complications. Please, please, please send us email info@ProfessorBuzzKills, you know, join us on the Twitter and all that stuff. Fortunately, despite all the threats of flooding, we haven't been overwhelmed yet, although it has started. A major rainstorm has just moved.
We have not
again.
Donned our hip waders yet.
Not yet, but it's looking pretty dicey. So before we drown, let me just say goodbye, and we'll talk to you next week.
This is General George Washington. I never go into battle or start a new country without consulting Professor Buzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please subscribe and leave him a review. Please also go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com to support him on Patreon, to subscribe to his email notifications, and to shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter @BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram @ProfessorBuzzkill. Thanks for listening.